From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The mountains are calling, and I must go. More than a century after naturalist John Muir wrote those words, millions of people from around the world every year flock to U.S. national parks, the very parks that he helped create. Muir is America's founding father of environmental preservation, co-founder of the Sierra Club, the sage of American wilderness. Now, history books have typically pitted Muir against Gifford Pinchot, creator of the U.S. Forest Service. Pinchot was a conservationist, a man who believed in using resources and preserving them, but using them for things like timber and drinking water, the greatest good, he said, for the greatest number of people. Well, my guest today says that, indeed, these two men had a rivalry between them, but that rivalry buries a deeper truth. They had a deep friendship. And that friendship between the two men helped create the system of public lands we enjoy today, and it perhaps also provides us with a template we can learn from to tackle modern-day environmental challenges. So this hour on Point, the creation of America's public lands. And you can join us. What do you want to know about the story of John Muir and Gifford Pinchot? What do you want to know about how America's public lands came to be public, and what do those lands mean to you? And joining us today from Bozeman, Montana, is John Clayton. He's the author of the new book, Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands. We have an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. John Clayton, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, as you might know, I just got back from a week in the Grand Teton National Park and in Yellowstone National Park, so I am replete with the wonders of nature as presented by our public lands, and I'm so excited to talk to you about the story of how these millions of acres that are so precious to this country, how they came to be preserved in the way they are. So first, let me ask you. We'll talk more about who Muir was specifically. We'll talk more about who Pinchot was specifically. But when did the two men first meet?
They first met in 1893 at Pinchot's family mansion in New York City. Muir was on being toured around by his magazine editor, meeting all sorts of intellectuals and writers telling stories. And the Pinchot family wanted to hear his stories about Alaska.
What would you give to have been a fly on the wall during that dinner?
Apparently, the servants would actually linger around to listen to the stories. They were like those flies. Yeah.
Well, and Gifford Pinchot was quite a bit younger than John Muir, right? So he was. Was he? How old was he when this meeting happened?
Exactly. Yeah, he was in his early mid 20s, while Muir was in his mid 50s. Pinchot had just gotten out of graduate school a year or two previously. And in fact, Muir thought that he was still studying forestry, didn't realize that he had actually been out practicing for a year or two at that point.
Okay. And so do we know sort of specifically with the impact that that meeting had on these two men?
We can see it a little bit in the letters. They began a correspondence at that point. Pinchot was eager to tell Muir how much he wanted to apply the lessons that he heard Muir give in that first meeting, how eager he was to get out in nature. And Muir always recommended that people get rich, by which he meant the opposite of making money. He wanted people to get out in nature and really enjoy and learn and feel the power of the divine force that he felt in wonderful natural environments.
Well, we'll talk about a trip that these two men took together not long after that and how pivotal that was. But I suppose what we should do is just step back a little bit and talk specifically about who John Muir was at the time and who Gifford Pinchot was, just to give ourselves a sense of how important in their own ways prior to their friendship, that these two men are for America's public land. So John Muir, I described him as the sage of the American wilderness.
Right.
What was his reputation like in the late 19th century?
Muir is a fascinating man for many reasons. One is that he really didn't gain his public reputation until fairly late in life. At this point in the early 90s, he had not yet written any books, only essays. But he sent these essays from the wilds of Yosemite into the magazine editors in New York, and they were sort of flabbergasted at his unique voice. He really invented the whole genre of what we today know as nature writing, the combination of description and memoir and sort of spiritual rapture that nature can bring about in very special places.
Can you talk more about that? Because, again, like I said, I'm still feeling the profound spiritual joy of having walked the South Rim Trail at the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone here. But what is it that Muir captured about the American wilderness that was such a unique voice at the time, but also spoke so much to so many people?
To me, I think what was really unique about Muir was that he saw nature as God and God as nature. And, you know, previously in Christianity, there had been a lot of fear of the wilderness, and Muir saw it as a wonderful, joyous place. He would go off hiking with hardly any food, no pack animals, no real plan, because he trusted that God, that nature would not hurt him, that he would survive somehow, which was a unique step for America in the 1800s when so many people had suffered so much on the frontier. And then he captured that naive enthusiasm in his writing, and he was just sort of effervescent in his ability to describe how he felt in a place, not just what it looked like, but what that caused his heart to do.
Mm. And so he then becomes this central figure in the idea of the preservation, right, of America's wild lands.
Exactly. In a place like Yosemite, which was so beautiful to him, he felt a divine presence there, and he wanted to preserve that. And every time humans tried to develop Yosemite, they ended up sullying it. And so he's feeling that nature needs to be held separate from that degrading human presence.
Mm. So unsullied nature was John Muir's
exactly.
primary concern
right.
here. Now, contrast that to Gifford Pinchot. He's held as a central figure in the American conservationist movement. As you said, he comes from a wealthy Eastern family here. What were the influences of nature in his early life?
Pinchot's family money had largely come from timber. His grandfather clear-cut forests in Pennsylvania, floated the logs downstream to be sold, and then just got rid of the denuded field of stumps that's not going to be useful anymore. And so that was Pinchot's grandfather. Pinchot's father, growing up with that experience, came to really regret it, came to feel that he had somehow murdered these living forests, and dedicated his life to cultural and also environmental advocacy. How can we save these forests? And so Gifford and his father, James, together, when Gifford was a teenager, decided that Gifford would become a forester and really become a leader in trying to sustain these forests so that we would have some always in the future.
I love that. Does his father just basically ask him, like, what would you think about being a forester when you grew up?
It's a little bit difficult to read through Gifford's diplomatic memoirs. He implies that they sort of jointly decided, and I can't tell whether they had this wonderful, loving relationship or whether James was maybe a little bit domineering. But yes, it ended up being certainly a very productive relationship and a very important one because, you know, at the time people were cutting down trees so quickly that there was even some concern that there would be a coming timber famine that within 20 years we would run out of wood. And of course, wood fueled so much of the economy back then that was a huge, huge deal.
So we have to talk more about that, right? Because I think it's so hard to imagine that actually not that long, it didn't take that long for early America to chew through its natural resources, or early America as a nation to chew through its natural resources. What were the conditions of forests and government-owned land near the close of the 19th century?
So the American philosophy especially in the 19th century, was always to keep government small so that you keep the power in the hands of the people. And to keep a government small, you want to limit government land ownership. And so any government land should be intended for giveaway or disposal to the general population. And so this was, you know, the homesteading, the famous policy of, yeah, if I just live on this plot of farmland for 5 years, the government will give it to me for free because the government shouldn't own land. The middle class should own land. That worked great in the Midwest and even on the plains. But when it came to forested areas, especially in the Rocky Mountains, the acreage that you could get on a homestead wasn't big enough to support you. And so people started finding ways around the homesteading laws, which typically involved basically handing them over to large timber companies. And there was a fair deal of fraud. And suddenly the timber companies started acquiring huge tracts of land from the public domain, from the government, from the taxpayers, and making a huge fortune on it by cutting down all the trees and then, like Pinchot's grandfather did, just sort of leaving the land as a waste product.
Well, we are talking this hour with John Clayton. He's author of Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands. We'll take a quick break, going into the break with Yosemite by Parker Millsap. This is On Point.
One of these days I'm gonna strike it rich. I'm gonna take you to Yosemite Park and we'll talk till it gets light when it gets dark. One of these days I'm gonna make it big. I'm gonna take you to Sequoia. Well, I hope I don't annoy you, 'cause you're coming with me when I go.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with John Clayton. He's author of the new book, Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands. We have an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. We want to know what your question is about the modern day state of America's public lands, both national parks, national forests, wilderness areas. And as we learn more about the relationship between Muir and Pinchot, what lessons their story has for us as we face modern day environmental problems. John, if I can, I just want to hear a little bit more about the sort of state of the forest, specifically the Western forest in the late 19th century here. You started telling us a little bit about it, but if we hear more, I think it will help us understand why the coming together of Muir and Pinchot was so consequential here. Because you tell a story about, Sequoia National Park Superintendent James Parker, who once took a trip a little north to inspect the Sierra Forest Reserve in 1894. And what did he find at that time?
He found it totally denuded by sheep. He described it almost as a desert instead of a forest. It was a classic sort of tragedy of the commons, where if this land was jointly owned by the government, it was owned basically by nobody. And so if you wanted to feed your sheep, or if you wanted to cut some trees, or if you wanted to do anything, you could go ahead and do it on these public forests, and there was no mechanism for regulation or policing or any sort of control management of these lands. There was an expectation that soon they would be privatized, soon they would be homesteaded. But as population sort of moved faster than homesteads could, you might find that the land would be totally denuded of its trees or of its grass, in the case of grazing lands, before a homesteader could get there and fence it off and create the private property rights that would really make it work.
I see. So then what was the Interior Department's response to, you know, these vast swaths of land that were being lost?
Well, there was a lot of confusion in the Interior Department and in Congress. You know, what exactly do we do? There was a push from the scientists and the elites to, well, let's give some more control over this land. Let's declare it public land. Let's declare that the federal government will own this land forever and manage it responsibly. And yet that was such a huge change from the traditional philosophy of, well, no, the federal government shouldn't have any power, that it was something that people were very reluctant to embrace.
Okay. So that sets the stage as to why the relationship between Muir and Pinchot is so important. Can you tell us a little bit more about this trip? This camping trip that both
right.
of them took a couple of years after they had first met in Pennsylvania.
This was how I first got into this book, discovering that they had camped together on the shores of Lake McDonald in Glacier National Park in 1896. It was midsummer. Lake McDonald is just this gorgeous fjord-like lake, totally clear water, colorful pebbles on the bottom, beautiful mountains in the background. And at that time, this was part of this public land that was waiting to be homesteaded but hadn't been homesteaded yet. And so, there are a few notes from Muir's journals and Pinchot's letters that describe it, that describe their meeting there. But, you know, one of the things that they must have quickly agreed on was that this land is so special, we can't just let it be carved up and chopped down and turned into the standard sort of farming or timbering homestead. We need to set it aside, as Yellowstone and Yosemite at that point had already been set aside. But what format should that take? When I first discovered this camping trip, I imagined them arguing.
Mm-hmm.
Muir saying, okay, this is so beautiful, we can't touch it. We can't let anyone do anything that would disturb it. And Pinchot maybe would have said, oh, we could put the dam over there and we'll cut those trees first and those trees later. And Muir would have just, you know, the steam would have been coming out of his ears. But in fact, they got along. The bigger crisis was the fact that some protections needed to be afforded to this land. The first step was for the government to assert its responsibility to claim, okay, yes, we are going to own this land. We are going to manage this land. We're going to establish some rules for how this land will be developed.
I imagine that same sort of perhaps vigorous conversation under the bowl, right, of a Montana night sky.
Exactly, with the campfire, and
exactly.
Pinchot is a great fisherman. He'd caught a bunch of trout, and so they're eating this wonderful food. And I think there's something about being outdoors in that wonderful environment that it's really hard to be angry and argumentative in that situation. It's really going to encourage these sorts of collaborations and this sharing of perspectives and seeing where you have common ground.
Okay, so there was a collaboration and an overlap of perspectives between these two men. How did then they take that forward and help encourage the passage or enactment of laws that brought us to the combination of public lands and national parks that we have today? What did they do?
So the reason they were in Glacier, they were on a lengthy tour of Western Forest as part of the National Forest Commission, a group of experts that had been asked to decide what the policies should be for these public lands. And the commission actually made a few mistakes in terms of their political savvy, and they got into a crisis the following spring where it looked like Congress was ready to get rid of all of the national forests that had existed for 5 or 6 years at that point and really trash the whole notion of public lands other than national parks. And Muir and Pinchot combined their talents to rescue these national forests and the laws that were governing them. Muir, by using his rhetorical gifts to write articles in magazines such as The Atlantic and Harper's, extolling the wonders, the beauty of these natural environments and sort of the moral authority that he had to say this is important. And Pinchot to talk about forestry and sustainability. He really taught Muir about the value of forests in that regard. And Pinchot then also ended up administering this nascent bureaucracy long before it became the Forest Service. He's known for founding the U.S. Forest Service, but he was actually sort of administering the forests for a few years before that with just, he was an organizational managerial genius, and you could trust that he would balance all of the competing interests effectively on public lands.
So Muir then stirs the soul, right, about the importance of protecting, I'm not going to use the word right, preserve or conserve, but protecting
exactly,
these public lands. But Pinchot, as you said, he has the sort of the managerial genius here. We should also note, though, that he had the ear of President Roosevelt, right? And so, so can you talk about the relationship that he had with Teddy Roosevelt?
Pinchot and Roosevelt were very much cut from the same cloth. They were patrician, Eastern, Protestant, wealthy men. They first met when Roosevelt was governor of New York, and Pinchot stopped by, and they decided to box and then wrestle. They loved that physical life. They loved the outdoor life in the West. And so they became close friends long before Roosevelt became president. And when Roosevelt was president and Pinchot was already in the administration, Roosevelt relied on Pinchot for all sorts of advice on environmental policy. As we look back today, Roosevelt, wonderful character, but in terms of his legacy, historians believe that his legacy in conservation was his most important legacy, and that's due almost entirely to Pinchot. Pinchot wrote all of his speeches on conservation and even wrote the chapter of Roosevelt's autobiography about the environment.
Huh, interesting. Well, we're talking this hour with John Clayton. He's author of the new book, Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands. Let's take a quick call. Rich is calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Rich, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Magna. I am a longtime listener and now a first-time caller. I really, really appreciate your show and your work, and I'm enjoying this topic very much, and very much enjoying listening to the author speak about this. If I might, I'd like to add in one factor that's missing. I realize it's perhaps a little bit out of the scope of his particular focus on the book, but it is very integrally related, and that is a lot of people, you mentioned you just came back from Yellowstone and the Tetons.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
a lot of people do confuse the national parks and the national park system with the national forest mm-hmm. and the national forest system under agriculture, the parks, of course, being under interior. Mm-hmm. And there's a personality behind that that's missing from the discussion, and that would be Stephen Mather. He, of course, came into play about 20 years after this first meeting between Muir and Pinchot. Around 1915, Mather was actually descended from the famous Boston Mathers of Cotton and Increase and Richard and crew. he was a high-strung Chicago entrepreneurial businessman and newspaper publisher, but he loved to hike. And speaking of John Muir, he loved to go to Yosemite. And, of course, Muir was highly responsible for the protection of Yosemite first as a state park way back in the Civil War time period. And in 1915, he played a visit out there and was appalled with the state of the trails, and he had gone to UC Berkeley, and it just so happened that one of his classmates was Secretary of the Interior at the time, Frank Lane, and he wrote him a letter of complaint, and he got a one-sentence reply that said, Steve, if you don't like the state of things, come on down to Washington and fix them yourself. And that's what he did. He lobbied Congress for a year, and that's the result is the creation of the National Park Service.
And he was the first director of the National Park Service.
But you know, they were, he and Pinchot, from that point on, were really at odds with one another, and the missions of the two agencies were at odds, and there was a bit of a rivalry. I mean, I think the last time, as far as I remember, that Interior tried to grab the National Forest System from agriculture was during the Franklin Roosevelt administration. Secretary of Interior Harold Ickes attempted to do that, but obviously without success. So they remained separate. But anyway, I don't want to go on and on because I want to hear more from your author. I just thought I'd add that in, and very happy to be on the air today.
Yeah, Rich, thank you so much for your call. So, John, let me turn back to you there. And first of all, Stephen Mather, the first director of the National Park Service, your thoughts on him?
Just to allay some potential confusion, the first national park, Yellowstone, was formed in 1872. And then by the 19-teens, there were several national parks. And Mather wisely argued that you needed some sort of government body to manage all of them together. And so the National Park Service was actually established in 1916. And I agree with the caller. It's very much a sibling rivalry between the Park Service and the Forest Service from 1916 through the rest of the century. And so you see how sort of the disciples of Muir and Pinchot start interpreting their legacies in ways that really involve conflict. And so the Park Service became Muir's agency while the Forest Service was Pinchot's agency. He was gone at that point. He'd been fired in 1910 or so. But the Forest Service lived with these conservation principles. And so you started having this perceived rivalry between preservation and conservation, Park Service and Forest Service, Muir and Pinchot. That was what surprised me as I dug into the research and found that the rivalry was really among the descendants of these people rather than between John and Gifford themselves.
So they did not see themselves as rivals at all?
You know, they saw themselves as having different opinions about important matters, like many people do. You know, Muir was famously argumentative. Even John Burroughs, the famous nature writer, said something to the effect of, you know, John, I love you, but some days I want to thrash the ground with you because you're so argumentative. So Muir had disagreements with lots of people. He certainly had disagreements with Pinchot, but they weren't locked in this mortal combat the way Park Service and Forest Service people interpreted them as being later.
Well, on this rivalry or distinction between the Park Service and the Forest Service, let's go to William, who's calling from Peachtree City, Georgia. William, you're on the air.
Yes, my dad was a forest ranger for over 35 years, and I got to live on the first national forest in the Forest Service system, the Pisgah National Forest, which was donated by one of the Vanderbilts. He donated about 64,000 acres to start it. But my brothers and I actually got to live on the Pisgah National Forest and right near the Davidson River recreation area. Anyway, the split between the Interior Department, the National Forest Service came from the Department of the Interior. They split the lands between pretty much the preservationists represented by Muir and the conservationists represented by Pinchot.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, I'm so proud because after 100 years, the wisdom of Pinchot surpasses so much Muir's idea of let nature have its course, because over 100 years ago, we have more forested land now in the 48 contiguous states than we did 100 years ago.
Well, William, I got to take a quick break here. But when we come back, I'll get John Clayton to respond to your thoughts about the Forest Service versus the Park Service. So, William, thank you so much for your call. John Clayton, if you can just hang on for a minute. Obviously, this rivalry that we're talking about is alive and well here in 2019. But John Clayton's new book is Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with John Clayton. He joins us from Bozeman, Montana. He's author of the new book, Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands. And John, just before the break, you heard our listener there from Georgia speaking very proudly of the National Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, over that of the Park Service here. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts were on the fact that while Muir and Pinchot, while they were alive, they mostly didn't see each other as rivals, that their rivalry generations later still exists.
I have found that when I tell this story to people, they naturally line up on one side or the other. Pinchot and Muir are such embodiments of deep conflicts in the American character. Individualism versus community, rich versus poor, immigrant versus blue blood, and their philosophies, whether we manage or whether we leave alone, whether we're thinking about resources for people or resources for holistic resources for spirituality. These get at the core conflicts of the American character. And so people are always eager to choose sides. And I suspect that the Park Service and the Forest Service have sort of encouraged that that camaraderie against a common enemy. Well, we have this unique philosophy as opposed to those other guys. Mm. But I think more than within the bureaucracies, it's really within our individual characters, our individual souls, that we want to take sides this way. And yet, to me, one of the great wonders of the American experiment is that these two philosophies, these two types of characters have constantly been interwoven in our society. Mm-hmm. And when they braid together, we're strong.
Yeah. So to get back to the fundamental point you're making in the book, is that because of the alliance between these two men, we have this model of publicly owned lands that are managed for a whole diversity of purposes, for pure preservation and protection of wilderness spaces, and also for the more actively managed national forests, logging, recreation, etc. And that is what collectively that's the gift that have been given to us all collectively here by Muir and Pinchot and the work they were able to accomplish. But we do have to talk for a second about the fact that they did absolutely operate in opposite directions on some pretty critical aspects of life in Yosemite, for example, right? Like they did go different ways. They were direct rivals over the building of the Hetch Hetchy Dam, weren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. Hetch Hetchy, a remote valley in Yosemite, The city of San Francisco suggested that by damming that valley, they could gain drinking water. And Pinchot said, oh, yeah, greatest good for the greatest number over the long run. That San Franciscans really need drinking water on their lowland peninsula. And Muir looked at the Hetch Hetchy Valley as a twin to the Yosemite Valley, as this gorgeous place that should never be sullied by man, where we should go to experience the divinity of nature. And he said, no, don't touch. And it was a lengthy, protracted political battle that the city of San Francisco eventually won and the dam was created. That ended up being a wonderful spur to the preservationists, helped encourage Steve Mather to go form the National Park Service and really argue for the integrity of national parks, that they shouldn't be sullied by additional dams. And so that worked through the 20th century. But because John Muir died a little under a year after the final decision on Hetch Hetchy, it is sometimes seen as sort of the big fight of his life, that he was, always in battle with Pinchot and lost that final battle. And isn't that a tragedy?
Yeah.
When I dug into their lives, I saw this as, this was a place where they disagreed. This was a place where they even had heated arguments. And yet Muir had heated arguments with lots of people about Hetch Hetchy. It wasn't.
Yeah. As you point out, I would just want to give you credit for a wonderful metaphor that you have, that like our understanding of their friendship was drowned in the reservoir behind the Hetch Hetchy dam. And what we were left with is a sense of that rivalry here. I want to also get to another point about who we are referring to when we talk about public, as in the public lands, because I mean, you're there in Montana, you've got a couple of pages in your book regarding Glacier and the Blackfeet Nation. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. The eastern half of Glacier National Park was once part of the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. And in about 1895, George Bird Grinnell, the famous conservationist and indigenous activist, that is to say, activist for indigenous people, was part of a team that negotiated the sale of that strip of land from the Blackfeet tribe to the federal government. At the time, the point was that some miners had, prospectors had potentially discovered gold there, and they wanted to make sure that prospectors wouldn't overwhelm the reservation and cause all sorts of harm, as had happened in many other places. It turned out that there actually wasn't any gold on those lands. The prospectors came and then left, and Grinnell was able to engineer the land to become part of Glacier National Park. The tragedy was that in that 1895 treaty, the Blackfeet had asked, they said, sure, we'll give up ownership of this land, because, of course, ownership hadn't really meant much to indigenous societies. Mm-hmm. But we do still want to be able to hunt and fish and use these lands, even cut selective timber. And so it was written into the contract that they could do so on public lands.
Huh.
And when the park was created, they said, okay, these are no longer public lands, and the Blackfeet rights were extinguished because their definition of public lands had been the 19th century definition where, well, these are lands that are not yet homesteaded. And any land that has a purpose being a national park or a national forest, well, suddenly now those are not public lands. So the government was in the curious position of arguing that a national park is not a public land. Which turned out to be supported legally, but sort of a real tragedy, because Grinnell had seen the value of public land owned by the American people as a whole without realizing that he sort of had a model there of the Blackfeet public land having been owned by the tribe as a whole.
Mm. Well, let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. In Glacier National Park, the glaciers are essentially gone. Assuming this is due to climate change, could this be the beginning of our inability to preserve our national parks?
Jim, thanks so much for your call and your question. John Clayton, Jim gets us right to one of the big lessons in your book. So first of all, address his question about could we be losing all the things that make in Glacier? It's such a spectacular national park.
Jim is absolutely correct. The glaciers are shrinking. In a matter of decades, we could be visiting glacierless national park. And that suggests that in order to preserve the conditions that people like John Muir love, we may need to take more management action than we have in the past. You know, John Muir said, well, hands off this beautiful, divinely created space. And now we're realizing that, well, you know, hands off the land itself is not enough because these lands are affected by global influences such as climate change. And so we may need to take stronger management action, which again suggests that preservation and conservation are not these opposing philosophies, that we need a merger of these rival or enemy perspectives in order to solve some of the challenges we're facing today.
Do you see that as a possibility, given honestly, I mean, given the sort of current political climate that we're in? Because I think one of the big differences is, as far as I see it, is that ultimately we can have these kinds of Muir-Pinchot-type alliances. But if leaders at the highest levels of our government are not taking seriously the environmental challenges, then to what end, to what good do those alliances come to?
I agree. It sure seems hard right now. But what I learned in the research for this book was that it sure seemed hard in the 1890s. That was an era when, as I mentioned, they were expecting to run out of trees, when the bison were nearly extinct, the passenger pigeon was extinct. They expected other animal species, elk and bear and maybe even deer, would go extinct because the entire country would be developed and there would be no room for nature. And all that was happening at the same time of huge income inequality, where the robber barons, that version of the 1%, were soaking up all of the value created by the growth created by that destruction of nature. And there was a dithering Congress that was doing nothing, that could not figure out how to solve those problems. And it could look pretty bleak at that point. And yet somehow, out of those bleak conditions, we did get this platform of public lands that has worked for 120 years.
Mm. If I may, though, I mean, for example, when John Muir was writing in his, you know, deeply heartfelt, spiritual way about about nature, that's something that people could tangibly see, right? And the destruction of it, we could tangibly see. Now, though, we have a problem where we still have people who were very powerful who are flat out just denying that things like climate change even exist. So how do you break through that? If it's, you know, if the change, look, climate change is having an immediate impact in certain places that we can see year upon year. But in other places, perhaps you can't see it as much as you can see a denuded forest in the 1890s. So how do we overcome that?
I wish I had an easy answer for you. If I did, I would be out there deploying it.
I'm asking because in your book, like you write that we need a Muir-Pinchot-style alliance that can show that different perspectives can come together to create a common solution for us all. And I'm just wondering if, you know, what would that alliance look like today?
I think one thing that alliance would include would be, a merging of differing perspectives, perhaps unusual perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so you might have a genius writer who can describe the wonders of nature combined with somebody who can better describe the difficulties of inequality or the challenges of business and economics. Perhaps the alliance today, rather than being Muir and Pinchot, would be somebody who's really into nature with somebody who's an immigrant fresh off the boat from, you know, the Middle East or from Central America, or perhaps it's with a transgender advocate, or perhaps it's with a libertarian, or perhaps it's all of these people coming together. Because the amazing thing about the 1890s solution was that it solved not only the environmental crisis, but to some extent the inequality crisis, because no longer were the large companies able to take advantage of the publicly owned resources.
Hmm.
And so to merge these things, I think too often we get sort of tunnel vision in thinking only about climate change. But maybe there's a possibility for these all to come together.
Yeah. You know, we should also acknowledge that a federal management of any kind of land, especially in the Western United States, never stopped being controversial, right? I mean, we still have lots of resistance to that. To this day and age. That's a conversation for another hour, but I just wanted to acknowledge it, that it's not – we don't have necessarily a perfect Shangri-La where everyone agrees that federal involvement in the management of public lands is a great thing. But in the last minute or so, minute and a half that we have, John, I was wondering if you could just tell us, what is it about Muir and Pinchot in your research about their friendship that most surprised you about these two men?
The surprises to me were continual. I was surprised that they were friends. I was surprised that they learned so much from each other. I was surprised that the benefits of that collaboration came at such a crucial, underappreciated moment in our environmental history. And then I was surprised that so few people have appreciated that, and so many people have preferred to emphasize the conflict rather than the collaboration.
Hmm. Well, I'm seeing here that Gifford Pinchot, in his own autobiography, I think, which was that published posthumously?
No, but towards the end of his life in the 1940s.
Yeah, that he himself wrote about he said the few friends of the forest that the forest had when spoken of, if they were spoken of at all, were talked about as impractical theorists, fanatics, or denudics. Did I say that right? Or more or less denudiacs, or more or less touched in the head. But I suppose that people still say that now about some folks who are really urgently concerned and properly about climate change. And yet Muir and Pinchot changed attitudes in the late 19th century. I don't see why we can't do that in the 21st century, John. What do you think?
That's what I'm hoping for, absolutely.
Well, John Clayton's new book is Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you, John. Thank you so much, and thank you for the book.
Oh, thank you, Megan. It's been wonderful.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.